I'm Stephen Brook, and welcome to Media Talk. Coming up this week.
If you can imagine sharing a waterbed with a baboon that's just been doused in etching powder, then, and only then, can you begin to get the picture.
As Jeremy Clarkson and other top TV stars are told to expect huge pay cuts, we'll analyse belt tightening at the BBC. Also in the podcast, just 1 week ahead of the Digital Britain report, it's all change at the DCMS. We'll talk about the job ahead for our new Culture Minister, Ben Bradshaw, and his suitability for the role. Plus, is it game over for Setanta? And
you've got two really quite small bedrooms. Those are dangerous, just make it bottom heavy, and it's unnecessary extra reception space.
The Beanie's back. We'll look at credit crunch property shows and the rest of the week's television. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Well, it's the start of my 3 week residency in the Media Talk hot seat, and despite the tube strike that forced many in London to work from home, my two panellists have braved the crowds and the congestion to be here in the studio. Steve Busfield is The Guardian's Head of Media and Technology. Now, there's no tube where you live, Steve, in Crouch End, so you wouldn't have been affected by this strike. Are you in here just to keep tabs on me?
Yeah, but I provide a chauffeur service for my wife and children in the mornings. I also think that, you know, that all of our non-London listeners are probably thinking, will they stop going on about the tube strike? Nobody cares. And do you know what? Actually, the chaos hasn't been that bad, has it?
No, it's been a bit of a damp squib. But then, anyway, we could discuss enough. The tube, but we'll fall into that trap. Paul Robinson is a broadcasting analyst and managing director of Kidsco TV. A man of your means, surely you don't take public transport anymore, Paul.
Oh, my Oyster card is glued to my pocket. Now, what I think has been fascinating is all the wobbly cyclists and people on rollerblades. I mean, they're the biggest hazard.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, I nearly got knocked over by a cyclist on the canal outside the Guardian.
Stop talking about the tube strike.
Good idea. Why don't we see what is on the box?
It's Valentine's Day in the square, but will Bradley come out smelling of roses? EastEnders in half an hour, here on BBC One.
Well, it's been another rough 7 days for the BBC. After last week's controversy about overpaying its big-name radio presenters, which was discussed here, a number of the Beeb's top TV earners, like Jeremy Clarkson and Terry Wogan, were summoned to an emergency meeting at Television Centre. There, they were told by Mark Thompson that they should expect pay cuts of between 25 and 40% when their contracts were renegotiated. All of that came after the Tories questioned the validity of Sir Alan Sugar's proposed dual role as star of The Apprentice and his elevation to the House of Lords. Finally, a new report from the BBC Trust stated that the corporation, quote, faces challenges in engaging with younger people. Well, we'll come to all of that in a moment. But first, Paul and Steve, let's talk about this meeting, which sounds pretty extraordinary. It was a real who's who by all accounts, Paul Robinson, and caught everyone by surprise. We reported that one star thought, he said, I thought we were going in for a sociable glass of wine and canapes, and that says it all.
Well, I guess always easier, I think, when you're working in the BBC to discuss tough things with talent over a drink or a meal. I mean, certainly in my experience at Radio 1, it was less likely to cause a tantrum. But, of course,
guys didn't know what was about to hit them, though, did they?
No. What I think is important here is that the BBC, clearly, as a public service broadcaster, has to be highly responsible in terms of what it pays for talent. And I think if you talk to the commercial sector, they will say there is a lot of evidence now that suggests the BBC has overpaid to keep talent at the BBC. And in so doing, you have to ask the question, is it right the publicly funded broadcaster is effectively driving the talent market rather than responding to the talent market? I think what's really interesting here is why these cuts are quite so large, because in terms of the BBC's total funding, it's not under the same sort of pressure commercial broadcasters are. The licence fee, clearly, you know, is the one amount of income in the broadcasting sector that's pretty much secure and clear where it's going in terms of how big it is.
Well, Steve Busfield, the cuts are large and they're going to hit the biggest star names, such as Jonathan Ross, Graham Norton, Terry Wogan, the hardest, because it looks like the cuts for the superstars are going to be closer to 40% than 25%.
The point of this story is that it's about the extraordinary times that we've been living through and the extraordinary times that we're going into. You know, Gordon Brown said there would be no return to boom and bust, and actually what we had was a fantastically boom-filled period, and now we're going into a terrible bust. And over the last sort of decade, TV talent has seen its wages rising quite seriously, and particularly over the last sort of 3 or 4 years, particularly since the Jonathan Ross deal, when all of a sudden it became key that that the main channels had to hold onto their top talent. And then it's become clear that actually those deals, they can't afford those deals anymore. ITV has been talking about renegotiating its deals.
DECK now are in line for pay cut as well, aren't they?
Exactly. And at some point, maybe even Simon Cowell will receive slightly less. But what had sort of helped fuel all of those deals was the fact that, the BBC would say, well, in order to keep hold of these people and stop them going to our rivals, we need to pay them commercial rates. The fact is that their commercial rivals can't pay those rates anymore. There is no danger that somebody is going to offer £18 million for Jonathan Ross to go there. So they don't need to pay that amount of money anymore.
But is it right to take it out on the talent? Because you had Director General Mark Thompson standing up, wagging his finger at all these top stars, and he earns something like £647,000 a year plus bonus. Should he be looking in his own backyard?
Well, if you look at the current economy and the situation we're in the country, then there are companies who are shedding people, there are executives foregoing bonuses, there are people taking pay cuts. So the BBC's issue is it generally can't afford to pay the talent what it paid before, historically. Then it should be looking across the piece. It should be looking at senior executives, Mark Thompson included, and reviewing those that pay as well. I suspect there's a little bit of opportunism here, as Steve was saying, because there's now no real market for talent, they're able to actually cut these fees significantly and therefore are doing that.
And retain the stars. Final thought from the blog from our commenter Bugbear, who said, memo to the BBC, just abolish the licence fee and nobody will stick their noses into what you choose to pay your stars again. Moving on, in other BBC news, there's a problem brewing over Sir Alan. Now, the Conservative Party is none too thrilled with the prospective enterprise czar. Steve Busfield, do you think that he can do both jobs?
I'm not even sure he can do either.
No, because you're not a big fan of him, are you?
But
do you care?
It's one of those funny things, isn't it? You sort of see Gordon Brown get celebrity involved with government, and you think, how much are they actually going to do? How much actual, brains are they going to bring into this? And he probably can still, he seems to have managed to have some sort of business career at the same time as running a BBC reality TV show. I don't see why he can't, do a job in government that I'm not really sure what it is and still do a BBC TV show.
Yeah, well, I was now just remembered that the other person he tapped up who actually said no was Fiona Phillips from GMTV. So surely these positions aren't too taxing. She was going to be some sort of health. Yeah, the mind boggles. But there is a precedence, because when Melvyn Bragg, Paul Robinson, became a peer, he had to give up Start the Week when he was elevated to the peerage because there were questions over impartiality and how can you run a radio show and be a member of the Labour Party. But in fact, The Apprentice is a bit of a different kettle of fish, isn't it?
I think the important point here is The Apprentice is actually an entertainment show. It's not really a business show. And I would draw a parallel here with Sir Alan Sugar and Andrew Lloyd Webber, appearing on the BBC and being a peer.
Yeah.
No one said you can't solve a problem like Maria or cast Joseph and be in the House of Lords. And I think the similarity really with Alan Sugar. I mean, look, he is actually acting. The whole thing is sort of pretty well prescribed.
The Apprentice.
Managed, it's quite stage
it?
Managed, yeah. And look, it's an entertainment, fun show. And this was a bit of a stunt, I think, by Gordon Brown, wasn't it? I mean, what's he really going to do? Not a great deal. I think this is the BBC getting a little bit over-concerned about it. I just move on.
Yes. Well, we will move on. And more on The Apprentice later with Gareth. But now, still with the Beeb and the youth. Paul used to run Radio 1, or a large part of it. Why is it the BBC is so good with children's programmes, on TV at least, but then it seems to mess up when it comes to slightly older people who've done their A-levels? We've had this big report from the BBC Trust out this week where basically they were kind of, a few criticisms about Radio 1 being too old, and BBC 3 has long been criticised quite often on this pod.
Well, I mean, youth audiences are hard to get, and you have to be fair to Radio 1. They actually do a pretty good job. Roughly half of all 15-24s do listen to Radio 1 at some time during the week, which is pretty decent. You know, BBC Three has a reasonable youth profile, not as good as E4, but still reasonably good. A couple of problems, really, I guess, for the BBC. The first one is that this is slightly self-serving in the sense that the licence fee is something they really want to protect. You know, it's the best means of funding the BBC we've yet to come up with. The BBC is wedded to it. And the licence fee is not as popular with young people as it is with older people. So they need to make sure that younger people really buy into the BBC and the licence fee. And that's really why they're concerned. In terms of how they deliver, I think you've got to think beyond traditional linear services. You know, younger people now are multitasking, using linear and non-linear services. And so just having television and radio services alone is probably not enough.
Yeah. Okay.
The other thing, of course, is that people in that difficult group between being children and adults tend to be out doing other stuff. You know, they tend not to be in the house because they're trying to get away from their parents. So their availability to listen or watch is also lower. So, you know, they tend to come back when they get their own kids. You know, that's when TV viewing starts to go up again. So there is a sort of life cycle thing in this as well. The BBC's got to continue keeping the pressure on youth audiences. And when I was at Radio 1, Radio 1 was less good at doing it than it is today. So I think it's a sort of 10-year reminder that you've got to keep on focusing on young people.
I'm Stephen Brook, and this is Media Talk. Still to come.
If you love the Oscars, but you always wish there were fewer celebrities and more awards, tonight is the night for you.
We're backstage at the Webby Awards in New York. And Gareth McLean popping into the pod for the last time. But first to our News in Brief section. Okay, you two, I thought we could start this by playing a little game of Who Am I? So fingers on the buzzers and jump in when you're ready. Who am I? I was born in 1960, the son of a Church of England vicar at Norwich Cathedral. I went to the University of Sussex, where I did a degree in German. I began my career at the Exeter Express and Echo and then worked at the Eastern Daily Press.
This is Ben Bradshaw.
It is, well done.
Yeah, although we'd have been out by now on University Challenge, wouldn't we?
Yes. Yes, well done. Ben Bradshaw being the new culture minister. In 86, he joined the BBC. Then he went on to be an award-winning Berlin correspondent for BBC Radio, covering the fall of the Berlin Wall. Joined the World at One, won the Sony News Reporter of the Year award in 93, elected as a Labour MP for Exeter in 97, and was one of the first openly gay members of Parliament. So congratulations, we've got a new culture minister. And Paul, there must be something that positive to be said about having a culture minister who's actually been a ex-regional newspaper journo and a BBC journalist, isn't there?
Well, yes, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I would say that the last really tuned-in culture minister who was there for a long time was Chris Smith.
That was a while ago,
and since then there's been quite a lot of change. I mean, Ben clearly is...
He was gay too, yeah.
I wasn't making that connection, and I'm sure there's no connection to be had, but I mean, he was the last one who I think who had a long tenure. Ben clearly understands it because he's worked in it, and that must be an advantage. And he's also someone who's got courage. You know, I mean, I think he's one of the first MPs who came out before he actually was elected, which I think is actually...
Yes, and actually the whole battle was against quite a homophobic, you can tell I've been reading Wikipedia, quite a homophobic conservative candidate. So he, right from the first go, he set out his stall. Steve Busfield, he is the fourth culture minister in 3 years. They seem to come and go quicker than Kelly Brook on Britain's Got Talent. Does this rapid succession of ministers actually show that Lord Carter is really pulling the strings, and does the culture minister really matter that much?
Well, we might well find out next week. Yes. when we get Digital Britain Stage 2. Does Carter pull the strings? He quite possibly does, although how much role government actually has and can wield on a lot of these things is I think quite minimal. I mean, yeah. I think they will do. I mean, Carter has said that he thinks there's a small and perfectly formed Act of Parliament that could come out of this, that it could be moved quite quickly. But what they'll actually be able to do is, you know, they'll only be able to tinker at the edges, and actually most of what they're going to try and legislate about is going to be decided by the market and, you know, and the bigger picture of the newspaper business, the TV business, the internet.
Could possibly be more a motherhood statement than a roadmap.
Exactly. Very good, I like that.
Okay, sticking with politics, have a listen to this.
Well, the BNP gained more than 120,000 votes, slightly fewer than 2004 in the Yorkshire and Humber region, with Andrew Bronze named as an MEP there. And its leader, Nick Griffin, was elected as an MEP in the northwest of England. And we can speak to him now. Well, congratulations.
Thank you. Good morning.
How historic is this?
I think this is a huge step, really. You know, for a party as demonised as the British National Party that's faced such an outrageous smear campaign, particularly with some newspapers such as The Sun and The Express, to have won two seats, it really is a big sea change in British politics.
Well, that was Five Lives' Nicky Campbell talking to newly elected BNP leader Nick Griffin on the radio this week. Steve Busfield, what happens now with the media and the BNP? Because, you know, there's been a great deal of criticism heaped upon the BNP, but suddenly they've got two members of the European Parliament. Have the rules changed?
Well, it's do you know what? I've had so many conversations in the last week that seem to have taken me back to being at college, where there was a whole sort of, you know, no platform for fascists and racists debate that went on endlessly. And, you know, and the fact is that the BNP have been elected, that there is a large chunk of the population that have voted for them, although I think if you analyse the voting patterns, no more people voted for them this time than previously. It's just that the number of votes for the main parties went down substantially because people were staying at home. Either because they couldn't be bothered, or actually I genuinely think because they were sat at home thinking, I don't want to vote for any of these parties, so I'm not going to. That no voting protest vote. So the BNP haven't actually got more votes, they've just got more members. And the fact is, you know, they've been elected, so they are going to have to be allowed to appear in the House of Commons. There was a fantastic comment on the Comment is Free blog yesterday from somebody who said that they would rather their taxes went towards paying for a moat for every single member of parliament rather than pay the salary of Nick Griffin.
Well, Paul Robinson, you're producing Question Time. Well, you're not, but if you are, do you now invite Nick Griffin on?
Well, I think you have to say people have voted for Nick Griffin and his party for maybe one of three reasons. Either they're actually genuinely racists, which is obviously completely unacceptable and abhorrent and ghastly, or it's a protest vote, or they're generally concerned about immigration issues. And I think the rise of the BNP is to some extent, although I accept the voting numbers that Steve's just quoted, is that the other parties haven't actually addressed it such the BNP becomes a non-vote. So I think you have to include them because they've been democratically elected. The issue is how much prominence do you give? And I think the problem over the last week or so is they've maybe been given too much prominence because it's been so shocking and such a startling development. They've got two MEPs.
That's true, but it was a big news story this week because it was the first time it happened. Now, looking ahead, it's not going to be such a big news story, so we may well hear from them less often.
Well, you certainly should. I mean, they should be treated as a minority party and they should be given no more than is proportionate.
Finally, in our nibs, we've talked about this company before, but it looks like Setanta really is on its last legs. Steve Busfield, what is the latest?
Well, by the time this podcast comes out, it could well have moved a whole away from where it is now. I mean, you know, this goes back to the very strange ruling. I mean, you could see the sense of the European ruling saying that, you know, that Sky had a monopoly on football and that wasn't right. Mm. The problem was that what they did was create a situation whereby it became more expensive for the viewer to see all of the games.
Because you had to buy two packages
instead of one.
Yeah.
And it put other people into a market where there was one enormously dominant player who have been dominant for a long time, who have invested billions. And, you know, Setanta spent a lot of money, were clearly quite optimistic with their business plan, and, you know, and their position has become almost untenable.
Question is, are they victims of the recession or are they the authors of their own demise?
I think they would have got into this bother whether there was a recession or not.
Because
they've spent a lot of money. They've not been able to recoup it. And Sky are a big, strong broadcasting beast.
Paul Robinson, you're a former Big Cheese at TalkSport. Mike, you have got around, haven't you? And now, presumably, you know a thing or two about sports broadcasting and rights issues. Were they doomed from the start, as Steve is suggesting?
there is no doubt that they overpaid for rights, and they might have got away with it had the economy been in a different situation. The reality is that Sky is an incredibly dominant and powerful player. And if you're going to break away, you've got to have a compelling offer that's enough to actually mean something. 46 Premier League games probably was enough. 23 certainly isn't. And the shareholders have obviously lost faith on just 23 games. They've paid quite a lot of money for the golf, for the rugby, for the Indian Premier League. And ultimately, it's just not enough to make the sums add up. So I think they're doomed. And I think the Premier League have to accept, too, they're going to have one buyer in future, which is going to be Sky, because ITV, Channel 5 are just not going to be in the game for those rights.
Yeah. Okay, more news and briefs next week. And if you want to have your say, post comments on the blog at mediaguardian.co.uk/mediatalk. Okay, time to go international. Your erstwhile, or should that be former host, Matt Wells, is currently in the US of A on something of a road trip. His first stop was New York, where he picked up Guardian.co.uk's 3 Webby Awards, also known as the Oscars of the Internet, in the Best Newspaper, Best Podcast, and Best Religious Site categories. Now, because there are about 70 awards at the Webbies each year, winners are famously rationed to speeches of no more than 5 words. Well, for someone so pleased with the sound of his own voice, it'll come as no surprise that Matt fluffed his big moment. Here he is with more.
Yes, I'm sent across the other side of the world to say 5 words, and I even managed to screw that up. Hopeless. Now, the rule with the Webbies is that your acceptance speech has to be 5 words. As I said, you record the speech in a video lounge, and they put it up on YouTube. Now, I'd concentrated hard on what to say on behalf of The Guardian in the best newspaper website category, and it went well.
Making life safer for liberals.
Yes, I thought that was quite a good line too. Obviously, I then completely lost concentration and I said this for the best podcasts category.
This is what The Guardian sounds like.
Well, it should have been The Guardian sounds like this. 5 words, not 7, but I got the syntax mixed up. So it just goes to show what happens when I don't have a script and producer Ben to keep me right. Plenty of others managed to get it right, though. Here are some of the good ones. This is from the none-too-reserved Economist magazine.
Read a fucking newspaper.
Next up, the dying Boston Globe newspaper.
It's not journalism that's dying.
Here's one from the Huffington Post.
I didn't kill newspapers, okay?
And this one is from the satirical news website, The Onion.
Happy 40th birthday, Sesame Street.
The awards were held in an enormous Italian restaurant called Cipriani on Wall Street, which is more the size of the Guildhall in London than Luigi's place in Stoke Newington, which I'm more used to. Now, I reckon there were about 600 people there. These events can be horrendously dull, especially if the host isn't up to much. But holding it all together this year was Seth Meyers, who's best known probably as one of the hosts of the satirical US TV show Saturday Night Live. And I thought he was very funny for an American.
It's great to be at Cipriani's on Wall Street because I think we can all agree that nothing says ingenuity and forward thinking and the future quite like Wall Street. Were there no rooms available in Detroit? Could we not find any Indian burial grounds on which to celebrate our achievements? The internet continues to be a great way to shop because there are very few real stores that will let you make your purchases and then hang around masturbating.
Now, some people have criticized the Webbies for being too big and sprawling and giving out awards for everything. So after the show, and in a still noisy venue, I asked David Michelle Davis, who's the executive director of the Webby Awards, to defend the ever-expanding cast list.
When we started, I would like to say there was, 15 categories of the Webby Awards, and there was probably less people online. And today there's, a billion and a half people online. So obviously we try and keep up with that. It's sort of a task that can never be met. It's always going to get bigger. There's still, whatever it is, 4.5 billion people that aren't online. So there's still a lot to come. We invite all the world to come vote on their favorites. So I think as long as we sort of keep doing that, it should hopefully stay relevant.
And what are your predictions for, say, the next year?
I think that Ben Ha from I Can't Have Cheeseburger and Failblog is going to come out with another internet superstar site, like he does every year, it seems like. So I think that's a prediction.
David Michelle Davis, he mentioned Ben Hur of Failblog and I Can Has Cheeseburger. He was one of the more popular winners of the night. Most humorous site he won for Failblog. He was one of a number of winners who were grouped together as internet famous. I asked Ben how internet famous differs from being normally famous.
It's not really actually famous. It's like pseudo-celebrity, I guess. Only famous when they can't see your face.
There was a smattering of celebs receiving and presenting awards. Karen Diaz, Lisa Kudrow, Arianna Huffington, Tim Berners-Lee. A very glamorous show all round, actually. Geeks can do glamour too, obviously. And there was the obligatory swanky after-show party where there was even some genuine New York hip-hop. Not really my thing, though, that. But proving that the Americans are suckers for a bit of schmaltz, the biggest applause for the night went to this five-word speech from Dick Bushman from the Netherlands.
Erna, will you marry me?
Oh, that is so great. Because at rehearsal, she kept saying no.
Dick Bushman, I'm not sure if that's a real name or not, but Matt Wells reporting there from NYC. Anyway, well done, Matt, producer Ben, and the rest of the Guardian pod squad for winning that Webby. Although my worry is, folks, with all this jet setting and award getting, Mr. Wells is going to come back even more big-headed than usual. Comments, anyone?
Couldn't possibly comment. I was just going to say, I hope they do that to the Oscars. I think if you ever sat through the Oscars, been lucky enough to sit through the Oscars for 7 hours, as you do, a five-word speech is very, very appealing.
Yes. Well, listen to more of the good stuff at guardian.co.uk audio. And thanks very much to the panel this week, Steve Busfield and Paul Robinson. Gareth McLean is next. Now, ladies and gentlemen, get out your hankies. Gareth McLean is here for his final, last ever TV review. It's the end, but the moment has been prepared for.
It has. Get out your hankies. I don't think people should be wanking over this, do you?
No. That's a quote. Who said that? It's the end, but the moment has been prepared for.
I don't know. Who's that from?
Doctor Who.
Oh, right.
Legopolis, when he fell off that radio telescope and regenerated.
Oh, from Peter Davison? Peter Davison.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think we're displaying our geek credentials a bit too obviously there, Stephen.
Moving swiftly on, yeah. Then, the Apprentice final.
Yeah.
I take it you watched?
I did watch. I'll be applying next year. When I'm Dole Scum, I'll be one of Britain's hottest, brightest business talents.
Well, it all seems to be a bit contrived, isn't it? And they actually film two endings, don't they? He tells them both that they're hired.
Yeah.
And then they sort of fake surprise, and then he actually, you know, months after filming,
they decide who's
on the weekend, he actually decides who's really got it.
I know, it seems a bit... I mean, obviously, it's totally contrived, and it always has been, and Sir Alan's a parody of himself now, if he wasn't before. But
Yasmina was a good winner, I thought.
Yes, well... It's like all those reality shows. What's the prize again? Yeah. Do we remember X Factor winner Leon Jackson, for example?
Yeah.
Or, you know, Big Brother winners or whatever it is, you think, that's quite a shit prize.
Yasmina's going to fade into obscurity, isn't she? Mm. I did watch Your... What's the show at the end? The Your Hire.
Your Hire with Adrian
Charles. Never watch. Mm. I was surprised to see Jonathan Ross.
Wow, I think the BBC are trying to get their money's worth, aren't they?
He's on every panel show. Of course, the big news about that was about Margaret's departure.
Yes. I understand they're lining up Maggie Brown to take her place. Mind you, if Nick goes, maybe I could take his place and me and Maggie could be Sir Alan's new hench people.
Actually, there is a show that I'm quite into at the moment. I'm running Sainsbury's.
Oh, no, that's awful. It's like a giant long advert for Sainsbury's. How did that get past product placement? Ofcom rules.
Well, didn't Channel 5 do a similar one about Tesco?
Yeah, they did, but that was about designing a product for the shelves, and it was much more about that individual's journey.
Right.
And that than it was just an hour-long ad. This is appalling. I get really annoyed with this, actually, because you're just like, this must be ad-funded content.
Well,
I spoke to Channel 4 about it.
Yeah, they were
And they
cool.
were like, no, it's fine. It's completely in la-di-da. In the third programme, there's some sort of negative stuff about Sainsbury's. And I was like, how many programmes are there? He was like, four.
Sainsbury's cops are mentioned every 5 seconds,
it's
doesn't it?
It's just shocking. If I was Tesco's, I would pull my advertising from Channel 4.
Well, actually, I used to.
If I was Tesco.
I found it interesting.
How grand am I?
Used to work in retail. I was a checkout chick. My finest hour when I was working at Woolworths Town Hall in Sydney was that I was very green on the job and mistook the fact that avocados are sold individually at $1.99 each, not $1.99 a kilo. They were going out the door that day, let me tell you. Okay, anything else that's caught your fancy?
Beanie's back.
Yeah, it's the wrong time of the economic cycle for a property show, isn't it? But they've given this one a twist.
Oh, yes. It's about, they've just added snakes at the end. It's sort of the same show. The developers are still a bit humble, but they're in really deep shit now because they don't have a rising market to help them out.
No, so actually...
Although I read today the recession's over. God, that was all flammed up, wasn't it?
Is Beanie grating on you, or are you?
No, I love Beanie. I've interviewed Beanie, and I have a bit of a crush on Beanie.
Really?
Yeah.
Right.
And I interviewed Richard Quest yesterday.
Did you?
I don't have a crush on him.
Right.
But he was
that
saying,
a phoner or a face-to-face?
No, that was face-to-face. Yeah, he was saying we could have a double-dip recession. You don't really want Richard Quest talking about double-dipping.
I just knew there'd be a smutty joke in there somewhere. Okay, well, that's it for this week. My thanks to Paul Robinson, Steve Busfield, and the wonderful Gareth McLean for making this such a breeze. You can post your feedback on any of our topics on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk or on our Facebook group. And remember, I'm here for another fortnight, so if you want to tweet me, if you must, search for SD Brook on Twitter. Media Talk's produced by Ben Green, and by the time you hear this, he'll be a married man. Congratulations, Ben. I'm Stephen Brook. Thanks for listening. See you next week.